to the Image Doctors. Today is January 26, 2006. I'm Jason O'Dell, as always, joined by my partner in crime, Rick Walker.
Hi, Jason. Hey, how's it going?
It's going good. Just got back from Texas. Like to say that today's show is brought to you by the Nikonians Photo Pro Shop, www.photoproshop.com, where you can buy a wider range of tripod accessories, Markins ball heads, Kirk lens plates, Arca Swiss plates for your camera, and a lot of other great products, including Nikonians caps and hats and t-shirts.
Yep. All the goodies we know and love.
That's right. So that's right, Rick. I just got back from the Imaging USA Expo in Austin, Texas. I learned that Austin was the capital of Texas, me being the geographically impaired one.
I lived in Texas for 4 years when I was in elementary school. And believe me, if you live in Texas, you have to understand Texas history, the capital. I know all about Sam Houston. I know my Texas lore.
Okay. Put away that Bowie knife.
Okay.
And I was at the Imaging USA conference on Sunday and Monday of this week. And I visited all of the trade show booths and met a lot of Nikonians. And before I get any further, I was really pleased to see some of our members there. I want to give a shout out to Mark Wagner and to Owen Richards and all the other Nikonians that I saw. And I hope I met you all and gave you a neck strap. I know I was trying to give out as many Optech neck straps as I could. And I also had an opportunity to visit some of the folks at the Nikon booth. I want to give a shout out to Bill Fortney and Trudy Talisha. Hi, guys, and I hope you're listening to our podcast. And thanks for putting a smile on your face when I came by the booth. Well, the Imaging USA conference was really good. All the big players were there. Like I said, Nikon was there. They didn't have any new things, but everybody wanted to hold a D200. They had those on the booth. They had a lot of real nice pro glass for people to play around with.
Always fun to do,
yep.
Right?
Epson had a really great booth there, showing lots of prints, lots of printers. And who else did I see there? I saw a lot of the big retailers were there, like B&H and some of the local camera shops in Texas were selling like crazy at the trade show floor. And in all, and they also had the centerpiece was a large photo exhibit, which was really nice. You could walk through and just see lots and lots of prints of really cool, high-end quality photography from a wide range of entries in their photo mm-hmm. contest. So I had fun. And I hope to meet more of you at the PMA trade show.
Both of us will be there.
And we're going to be doing a podcast from PMA. And if you want to meet the Image Doctors...
We pity you.
That's right, absolutely.
But nevertheless...
That's right. We'll be there. We'll be at the show. And it's February 26th through March 1st. We need volunteers to help us give out Nikonians brochures at the show. If you think you're going to be in the Orlando area between February 26th and March 1st of this year, and you'd like to volunteer a few hours and get a free pass into the PMA Expo, especially if you're a silver, gold, or platinum member, I'll give you guys priority. Send an email to us at talkradio@nikonians.org and ask us about how you can get a free pass to the PMA trade show coming up next month.
Great. Now let's talk about some of the other things that we're going to discuss today. One of them is listener mail, like we always do. And then we're going to spend some time talking about travel photography. And then the last thing is the recent announcement from Nikon regarding their film cameras.
That's right.
As well as some of the manual focus lenses.
A hot topic in the forums.
Very hot topic. How about if we hit the listener mail first?
Sounds good to me, Rick. We got several emails in the last couple of weeks since our last show asking us about our opinion of the new 18-200 Nikkor VR lens, comparing it with other lenses. Should I get this lens? Should I replace my 18-70 lens? How does it stack up against the 80-400 or the 70-200 VR lens? I will start off by saying that neither Rick nor I own this 18-200 lens. It's too new.
Yeah, I haven't had a chance to handle one even yet.
I've heard fairly good things about it in the few places that I've seen samples. It looks like a pretty sharp lens. I know from the tech specs it's got, I think, three ED elements in it. the extra low dispersion glass elements from Nikon.
Yeah, and you know what, these wide range zoom lenses, the kind of all-in-one sort of lens, they've really improved over the years. When they first started out, well, I mean, they started with some of the 35 to 200s, and then Tamron came out with a 28 to 200.
I used a Tamron 28 to 300.
Yeah, yeah. And a lot of them were okay. You know, some of the problems that they had were, you know, close focusing distances that weren't that close, and a lot of them would get a bit soft toward the long end. But, you know, many photographers loved them and still do, and find them an essential lens. Depends on your preferences. I honestly never gravitated to those lenses. I bought one of the 28 to 200 Tamrons around the time they first came out, and it was okay. I just found myself preferring other lenses instead, some that had a little bit shorter range and were a little bit faster in terms of maximum aperture. You need to figure out what camp that you're in, and you know, do you want just the one lens that goes on your camera? And it was a little bit of a compromise, but maybe not too bad a one. If so, the 18 to 200 is not a bad choice.
If you're just starting out and you're investing in a kit, and I understand, like, let's say you're getting a D200 or something, or even a D70, that's not a cheap investment. That you're spending a lot of money on a body. Hey, I've been there. And you might only have the budget for one lens. Now, the street price on the 18 to 200, I want to say, is around $700.
Something like that. It's not cheap.
It's not cheap, but it's not over the top. Right. Insane. Certainly not going to be a $300 type of lens. So my guess is it would be built a little bit better. And looking at the specs on it here on Nikon's website, it's not a particularly fast lens. It's a variable aperture, f3.5 to 5.6. On the other hand, it has the new VR system, which is supposed to give you three stops of hand-holding. With any VR lens, remember, that doesn't stop the action. It just allows you to stop camera shake. So if you're shooting a fast action subject, VR isn't going to help you freeze that action. That goes with any VR lens. One nice thing is you can put this lens on your camera if you're going on a trip somewhere and have one lens to walk around with. This gives you the equivalent of, in 35 millimeter angle of view, it's a 27 to 300 millimeter lens.
Yeah.
And it does focus down to 1.6 feet. Now, what's not clear from the spec sheet is if that focuses down to 1.6 feet at all of the focal lengths. That was the knock I had when I used the 28 to 300 Tamron. It was decent at the long end. At the wide end, I could only focus it down to 5 or 6 feet, which made it very unuseful for me as a wildlife nature shooter doing interesting wide angles.
Yeah, I think one thing that can be good about these all-in-one lenses, if you're relatively new to photography, is everyone gravitates to certain focal length ranges or focal lengths, and you won't know what those are if you're brand new to photography. So with a lens like this, you can get a sense of what are those ranges that you're likely to use a lot, and then maybe on a subsequent purchase, you get something that's a little bit narrower range, maybe a little bit faster aperture. And that becomes your favorite lens. And this is a good way of determining that.
And as an ED VR Nikkor lens, my guess, and it's just a guess, is that this lens would probably hold its value reasonably well. If you were to turn around and sell it in a year or two, it'd probably be a good investment, because it's a DX zoom, and that means it's, you know, you're not going to have any trouble unloading this lens on people who have D70s, D50s, or any other digital body and are looking
for
that. Lots
of people with those bodies.
But I say if you're interested in it, it's not going to be a bad lens, but as they say, you know, a jack of all trades can
master
be a master
of none. Yeah.
And not that this is a bad lens, but if you're comparing this to let's say, if you're debating this versus a 70 to 200, well, there's no comparison, in my opinion. The 70 to 200 f2.8 VR is a pro lens. It is priced accordingly, but it is by far one of the sharpest lenses I have ever used.
Yep, me too. And in addition to better low light performance, which translates also into better autofocus, you know, less likely that you'll
more
lose
accurate
light.
Autofocus.
Yeah. Yeah, more accurate autofocus. You can also slap a teleconverter on it, you know, one of the 1.4 teleconverters, and get very good results. And so that's an option that just doesn't exist. So there, it's kind of an apples and oranges situation. Right. They're really different tools for different situations, and you'll just have to judge what's more important to you.
If you've already got the 18 to 70 kit lens, that's a good lens. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, because the jury is still out, how much better the 18 to 200 would be. Yeah. Where it will shine is that you'll get that longer range.
Yeah.
So if you're looking for one lens to strap on your to mount on the camera and walk around with, that might be your choice.
Sure.
So that's what we think about that, and hopefully we'll be able to get our hands on one of these lenses in the not too distant future.
I suspect we will.
And give you some more hands-on feedback.
Yeah. Now, the next thing that we were going to discuss is that announcement regarding some of the film bodies. And as many of you probably know, Nikon announced that they were trimming back on their film camera line. They're going to keep the F6 in the line, and they're going to keep the FM10 in the line. That's actually a camera made by Cosina, interestingly, so it doesn't come off a Nikon assembly line. So it's really the F6 on the Nikon side, which shares a bunch of components with some of their DSLRs, so it's got some good manufacturing economies going on there. A lot of people were pretty panicked about it or worried about what this means, and I understand some of that for sure. I still use film. I like film. You know, I use digital as well. But, you know, I have to admit it was a little bit sad but expected. The market is very competitive, and if you can't invest your R&D into the areas that are really growing, then you might find yourself going out of the business, like Konica Minolta.
Yeah, that was a recent announcement last week. I mean,
right.
Let's take this in perspective, people. Nikon said, we're getting rid of the middle of our film SLR line, but more importantly, what they didn't say was that they're discontinuing all their film line. I think people freaked out when they saw this. And yes, it is disappointing to see that you're going to be losing. But I'm looking at Nikon's website right now, and in between the F6 and the FM10, they have 7 film cameras, F5, F100, N80, N75, N65, and 55 FM3A. Now FM3A, that'll be sad to see that one go. That's a heck of a camera. Mm-hmm. But what they did say is that they're keeping 2 film cameras in their lineup. That's almost as important or more so than saying they're getting rid of the mid-range film SLRs. They are showing, at least in this press announcement, that they're dedicated to film shooters still by keeping these cameras in their lineup.
Yeah, and the other important thing to think about is, with a lot of people converting to digital, there are a heck of a lot of film cameras on the market, and the prices are just ridiculously low right now. I mean, you can pick up an F5 or an F4 for just peanuts.
You can get an F5 amazing. For under $800.
And there's tons of F100s out there for sale. There's a surplus of film cameras, so that's another reason why this announcement makes sense. And guess what? Nikon cameras last a long time. I've still got my Nikon F that was made in 1972. Still works perfectly.
Yeah.
You know, I've had it since the mid-80s. And every other Nikon camera that I've owned and still own, because I've got a lot of them, they all work perfectly. None of them have ever worn out. So, you know, there's a huge market out there of used stuff. So just factor that in. I think there's more goodness in there in this announcement, actually, than there are issues. But you know, I do understand how
Nikon stated in their announcement as well, just in case you missed it, that they're going to continue to support the discontinued models for 10 years in terms of service and support from the time that they're discontinued.
Yeah.
So you'll still be able to buy a lot of these cameras new until the inventory dries up.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's not like Nikon came out and said, we are discontinuing our film line, we're destroying our stocks, and by the way, we're going to make sure that we're shutting down Kodak and Fuji's film production to make you guys go digital. You know, it's not that extreme. At the same time, it does signal a change in the market for what's out there in photography.
Sure, sure.
That's what we think,
yep. Now let's go on to our next topic, because we'll actually talk a little bit about film cameras as part of this. At least I will. And that's travel photography, which is the main subject that we were going to have for today's show. First, a little bit, what the heck is travel photography? Any thoughts? Jason?
Well, I don't know, but I bet you if you wanted to find something out about it, you could go to the new travel photography forum that we just created on Nikonians.
That would be true.
How about that for a plug?
Yeah, it is a plug.
Shameless promotion department.
Yeah, pretty much.
Well, travel photography is when you're going on a trip. Maybe it's a vacation. Maybe it's somewhere where you're not going for the sole purpose of doing photography.
Although you could be.
You could be.
Yeah.
Maybe you're taking a trip to Europe backpacking. Maybe you're going through multiple destinations. Travel photography to me is where you're going to encounter a lot of different circumstances. You may be taking pictures of buildings. You may be doing scenic pictures. You may be having a lot of people pictures because you're taking a picture of your spouse or your kids, whether you're in the plane, in the airport, or in the Sistine Chapel.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of restrictions sometimes on travel photography as to what to pack, what to bring, and what you might be allowed to bring into certain places that you want to take pictures at.
Yeah, and I think one of the key things for me with travel photography is that what you're really trying to do is capture the atmosphere of an area and its local culture, the people, the architecture, just the ambiance of the area. So that's what travel photography is for me, because in a lot of ways you could say, well, you know, it's really something that's made up of other types of photography, and that would be true.
It is a potpourri of photographic subjects, isn't
it?
Yes,
that's exactly the term I was thinking of. That would have been embarrassed to use. But so it's one of my favorite areas, actually. I truly enjoy it. The thing that's a challenge with travel photography, though, is that unlike with other situations, you may not have an easy way of transporting your gear. So if you're closer to home, you might be able to pile everything you own on the back seat of your car or whatever and take it with you and have easy access to it. When you're traveling overseas, you know, on airplanes, weight and space is a real consideration, and something that seems just great at home suddenly starts feeling very onerous. While you're out there. And I've felt that because I often end up taking more things than I really should.
Well, the airport is certainly a challenge now. Security is tighter. Mm-hmm. Weight limits have gone down on bags, having just come back from the airport. You know, it used to be you could have 70 pounds in your checked bag and it was not a problem. And now in the United States, at least, that's 50 pounds. Right. And in Europe, it's variable. There may be, depending on the different carriers that you're on, some of the more regional carriers may have even lower weight limits.
Yeah.
And they may strictly enforce them.
Yeah. When I was on a trip down to South Africa, your carry-on bag could not be more than about 8 kilograms. So that's not a whole lot.
That would hurt me.
It would hurt. It did. It was painful. I don't think they were actually tracking things that closely, but on the other hand, I didn't want to get my stuff rejected, so I got out the weight scale and all that kind of stuff, and it was tough getting everything in the pack. So that's often an issue anymore. The kind of trip that you're taking is going to really dictate your equipment choices, though. And I'll just throw out some examples of different things that I've done recently. I've taken a couple family trips out to the East Coast. I was doing some business stuff out there, too, and we did some things in Virginia, around Washington, D.C., in the Boston area. And although I've got digital gear, I actually took film cameras. I took my F6, in fact, with color print film. And rather than taking big and bulky zooms, instead what I shot with were some smaller primes. To me, it was the perfect time to go in a little bit different direction than what I would do here at home. You know, if the two of us were out doing landscape shots or wildlife, completely different. And there, I often, you know, like zooms because of the convenience they offer. But on this trip, I was trying to keep the weight down, and I was shooting in low light situations. And for the subjects I was doing, there were a lot of, you know, people shots, family and other people, architectural shots, you know, kind of on location kind of shooting. The primes were just nice. You know, I could set a certain aperture, do hyperfocal distance kind of stuff, so everything in a certain zone was in focus and sharp. And it was just almost effortless. It was really nice. And the cool thing about film for that kind of situation is, unlike with digital, where you really have to watch your exposure, just like you do with slide film, and be careful about not overexposing areas and burning out highlights, with print film, you know, it's a no-brainer. You can overexpose by several stops, underexpose by a stop, and the prints all come out fine. Really right. Doesn't make a difference. So you just kind of relax.
And one nice thing about print film in that regard, when you go on vacation and you come back, is that now you can have the 4x6s to put in your photo album of your trip all in one spot. Now, I know you can do that with digital too, but
it's just more of a pain in the neck. It's not bad if you do batch routines and things like that.
But if you want the prints to share with your family and say, here's the photo album, without having to fire up your laptop or your computer.
Oh, yeah. It's just so easy. And that's one situation where I still absolutely like using film. It works really, really well. And the other thing is logistics on your trip. I had my camera. I had three lenses that I took. I took a 20 2.8, I took a 35 millimeter f2, and I took an 85 1.4, and then I had some film. I didn't have, you know, portable hard drive. I didn't have to worry about a laptop to download the images to. It was just a piece of cake, really.
But you have to be careful about your film in the x-ray.
You do. The only thing that you really have to worry about is not putting it into your checked baggage.
That's right.
That's where it'll really get destroyed. The x-ray machines that they have in the security areas where you're just walking through them, those are fine.
I've never had a problem
with
in a lot of years.
The lower ISO films, you know, meaning something like ISO 800 and below, you're fine. You know, I've put film through those things a number of times on trips, and no apparent problem or damage. So for those kind of situations, I think film works well. And like I was mentioning, the fast primes are pretty nice.
Now, I took a zoom. I actually still had in those. I went to China a few years ago on a business trip, and I took my 28-300.
Mm-hmm.
And it was nice to not have to change lenses, but the one area where primes would have been nicer is when I'm traveling, a lot of times you're in indoor locations.
Right.
You have to think about where you're at. And a lot of these indoor locations, a lot of indoor locations won't allow photography. But let's assume that they do allow photography. They most of the time will not allow flash photography.
Right.
And even if they did, some of these things, like Napoleon's tomb in France, was so cavernous that it didn't matter if you could use a flash, but you're going to underexpose anyway. So in those conditions, a fast prime would have been a better way to go.
Yeah, and the other thing is just as aesthetic too. A flash, and unless you're using multiple flashes and doing some bounce things, which is just about impossible in a museum or something like that.
Especially if you're traveling.
Yeah, you know, in those low light situations, natural light is best. You know, you pick up the ambiance of the place.
I thought you were going to say those low life situations. I have lots of low life situations.
Yeah, low light. But that's where the fast primes are really, really nice. And you can get some very good looking photos, you know, with color print film and those fast primes, where your main subject is well exposed, looks good. But you can also see all those background details too. You know, where was it located? What was it like? And then also make the background nice and soft, too, by having a wide aperture. So there are a lot of pretty cool things about them, and that's something I like using in those sorts of situations. Sometimes I'll use a 17-35 zoom in conjunction with an 85, but lately I've been using the 20 and 35 a lot, and that works well for me.
Especially if you run into a place that doesn't allow a tripod.
Mm-hmm.
There are tourist places out there that they want you to buy their own pictures in their gift shop.
They could.
And one way they can sort of encourage people to do that is by forbidding tripods. Now, that may be a case where that three-stop of that 18-200 VR might come in handy.
Sure.
So you're trading off the slower aperture, but you're getting VR. So maybe it acts like that. Don't know.
Yeah.
But
it's not quite the same thing, but it meets some of the same needs. That brings up a good point with tripods. like you were mentioning, a lot of places, you know, cathedrals and stuff won't allow tripods in them. And there are some good reasons. It's not just all postcards and things like that.
No, you'll,
people, there's a lot of traffic and people can trip. They won't be paying attention. Someone's nice camera gets knocked over. Someone gets hurt. There are fire code issues in some cases with tripods in those kind of areas. So they just may not allow them. Now, one thing I've used a lot, and it works pretty well, is a tabletop tripod. I've got a little one that I've had for 20 years, and it's just got three legs that fold out and a little ball head on it, and you can put it up against a wall, you know, a vertical wall, and have your camera mounted on it and get some good shots. I've put it many, many times in pews and cathedrals, and there are lots of other places that you can place it if you use a little bit of creativity, and that's enabled me to get those natural light shots that I wouldn't have been able to get otherwise. So that's a really good alternative, and it doesn't take a lot of space either, which is important when you're traveling. So that's something I like to do. Filters, you know, it depends on what you're shooting with. If you're using film, then it is nice to have a few filters. I will usually take something like a warming and a cooling filter with me if I'm shooting with film, just to handle situations where I might be faced with incandescent light sources. You know, you don't want an orange looking picture inside a building, and so a light blue filter will help remove that. Also, if you're shooting outdoors and it's just really, really overcast, you can avoid those ugly blue looking photos as well. If you're using a digital camera, you know, just alter the white balance, and you may even have it set to work automatically, in which case it's often fixed pretty well.
And one of those really fun things I always come across when traveling, you were speaking about cathedrals, is the challenge of shooting stained glass windows. And whether you're shooting digital or film, there's a good time to use your spot meter.
Absolutely.
Because if you use matrix or center weighted in that situation, it's going to see the really... It's either going to try to balance things out, it's going to have a dark cathedral, and you're going to blow out the stained glass windows because it's going to be exposing for the shadows in the cavernous stone walls. So what I always do is just try to take pictures of the stained glass windows. I'll spot meter on it, on just the glass, and then and just accept the fact that the rest of the room will likely be dark. And that's okay, because you get back home and you see pictures of the actual detail in the windows, and that's what you want. That's what you want to share, the colors and the detail of all that handiwork.
Right. Now, a concept I saw several years ago in a book that's a favorite of mine, it's called Spirit of Place, which is written by a guy named Bob Crist, a very famous travel photographer, uses Nikons. He'll be the subject of an upcoming podcast, actually. We've got someone that's done an interview with him. And in that book, highly recommended, by the way, if you like travel photography, one of the things that Bob suggests is almost like a little checklist of subjects on a trip. And it's a great idea. Helped me break out of some patterns that I was in, where I would just take a certain kind of photo and not a lot of other types.
You end up with snapshots.
Well,
and trying to avoid snapshots, in other words.
The problem for me was that a lot of my shots were more architectural, you know, buildings and things like that, and they were often at kind of a certain distance. And in his book, he recommends that you think through in advance what kind of shots that you want to cover in a certain locale, write it down, and then take a look at it periodically to remind yourself to take these kind of shots. And I'll give you some examples. For someone like me that might gravitate more toward architectural things, one of the line items on there would be people photography. Some of the people living in the area, what are they wearing? What kind of activities are they engaged in? So like when I was in Morocco, taking pictures of people that lived there in the local markets, wearing the clothes that might be a little bit different than what we're used to, the kind of things that make the shots interesting to other people. And also varying the distance and the size of the subject. Don't just take pictures of buildings. Take close-ups of things. Again, in the market, you might take a close-up of something in a butcher shop. Might be kind of ugly in some cases. Or other things like that. It could be detailed shots of a building. Doorknobs and other decorations can be amazingly interesting sometimes and very, you know, photogenic. So it's the idea of varying those things across your shoot so that you end up with a set of images that have some variety to them and they aren't all the same, because that gets dull. And I thought that was great advice. It's definitely helped me with some of my shots.
That reminds me of the presentation that I saw by Dave Black when I was in New York City. Before I had interviewed Dave, he was giving advice on covering a sporting event. But the advice that he gave for covering a sporting event, for covering your travel, your vacation, or your trip, could very well be applied here too. And he said, think in terms of a coffee table book. Mm-hmm. Your coffee table book is going to have some wide shots. It's going to have some close-ups. It's going to have some different detail. It's going to have, you know, a variety of different kinds of pictures, not just snapshots of there's me in the corner, there's exactly. me in the spotlight. Wait a minute, I'm singing REM songs. But
it was catchy.
But that's right. Sounds like a slideshow, Wayne.
Yeah.
So, there's me at the Washington Monument, or you know, there's so and so standing in front with their arms folded in front of them. Another thing, like for when you have to take the obligatory people picture, you know, of your wife or your spouse or your
which
kids,
which you want to do,
which you will do, and you're supposed to do that, you know. What I see more often than not are people using a point-and-shoot camera, let's say, which has a wide-angle lens on mm-hmm. it, and then they step way the heck back. They're 20 feet away from you because they want to get you in the viewfinder and get everything in the background too. And whenever I take a picture of people, if you do it that way, you don't see the people's faces. They're just little dots in the picture, so you got to take three steps or four steps closer than you think you might need to make if it's the group shot of your family, you want to make sure that your family is recognizable. Mm-hmm. And people will believe you that you are standing in front of the Lincoln Memorial or something like that, or standing in front of the Louvre, because
there's still ways of incorporating the local environment into those photos.
Absolutely.
But getting closer is always good advice. Always good advice.
So, we've talked about a lot of the challenges of travel photography. A lot of them had to do with, of course, the what to bring or what not to bring. What about...
I'll tell you what I think is the most important thing now.
Okay.
Planning.
Yeah.
If you're really wanting to get some good shots in your trip and not just snapshots, you have to plan it. And that's true with every other kind of photography as well, right? You've got to do some research. You've got to figure out where you want to be at certain times of the day, because, you know, a place could look absolutely wonderful in morning light and absolutely horrible at noon. So you want to plan out your trip so you can be at those really desirable locations when the light is good.
Well, that reminds me of the Fifth and Pat, mm-hmm. because we did a little travel photography. We went to Mount Rushmore. Mm-hmm. And we got to the parking lot at Mount Rushmore before sunrise, because we're Nikonians and that's what we do. And we caught those presidents in that morning light. It only lasts for about 20 minutes. We were the only people there. No tour buses, no tourists, nobody shows up much before sunrise at Mount Rushmore because nothing's really open.
Right.
They've missed those pictures. When they see my pictures of Mount Rushmore, my pictures of Mount Rushmore aren't any better than anybody else's, but they're different, and different makes them have more impact.
That's right. That is absolutely true.
So if you can be in the right place at the right time and catch something in that morning, in that golden hour, you should do it. You should try to do it. Yeah. Now, if you're shooting digital, you can get away with a few little tricks, and you can tweak your white balance manually in Kelvin and get that look, but... You know, in general, it's always nicer to be there when the light is natural.
Now, the one last thing that I was thinking that we should discuss is issues with your family. And what I mean by that is you've got to decide when you go on a trip what the focus is going to be. Is it spending time with your family and being in the locations? Is it making photographs? Is it some balance of the two?
You mean sitting in a bird blind with your spouse for 6 hours waiting for the sun to come up?
That's sometimes a problem.
It's always a problem for me.
Yeah. So I think you've got to make a conscious decision about what you're going to do and know that it works well for your family also. I love doing photography, And I would be very, very happy going to some of these locations and just spending hours and hours making photographs. I can't do that. It won't work.
No, neither can I.
Family won't stay happy. So you've got to come up with a compromise that makes sense for you. So what I do is I just recognize that I probably won't get all the best shots on a trip. I'll get some decent ones, hopefully, but they won't necessarily be my best work, and be okay with that.
Yeah, and it really depends on where you're going, too. I mean, if you are going to a once-in-a-lifetime location, mm-hmm. if you're going to, say, the Galapagos, then maybe you need to talk with your spouse about the fact that here's a chance to do some serious photography, because that would be a major activity to do while you're there.
Yeah.
On the other hand, if you're going to Club Med, maybe that's not the time to bring the 70 to 200 and the tripod and all the other equipment. Maybe you just bring a point and shoot camera and take snapshots of your
sure.
vacation.
Sure.
So it really is going to depend on yeah. what you want to do.
Now, one thing that I have been able to do is sometimes schedule a little bit of time where my wife wants to do something else, and I'll go off for a couple hours and focus exclusively on photography, oftentimes with my son. And that works because she's not having to come along, sit around, wait for us to get our tripod set up and all this other stuff.
I have a trick. It's here. Honey, here's the credit card.
That works.
Go
too.
Have fun.
Yeah, that works.
And if I can get her to use her own credit card, it's better.
Yeah. Yeah, but it is an issue, and it's something that's worthwhile talking about in advance, just so that you don't have bad tensions develop on the trip and the enjoyment level go down. So at any rate, those were some thoughts on travel photography.
Yeah, as you can tell, it's a pretty diverse topic. We've got the new travel photography forum.
Yep.
It's under the image making and shooting issues forums section of the Nikonians forums. We encourage you guys to go there and visit. It's already starting to get populated with some interesting posts just in my casual browsing. So obviously we're not going to be able to answer everybody's question about travel photography, but that's what the forums are there for.
That's right.
So
and we'll do more podcasts in the future.
And we'll do more podcasts.
Yeah.
Much to some people's disappointment, I'm sure. So, Steve, if you're out there, I hope we were, I know you're listening. I hope you're not rolling on the floor laughing too hard at us this time. You can laugh with us and not at us. We appreciate it. But that is our show for today. Join us again in 2 more weeks.
Yep.
We wish we could do these more often, but right now we have to stick with our 2-week schedule. And join us next time when the Nikonians say, Rick, Jason,
I don't know.
Why aren't you out there shooting?
Oh, okay.
Or something like that. Well, tune in to Nikonians Talk Radio in 2 weeks for our next show. And don't forget to check out the Nikonians webpage for all our forums and our new product reviews. We got some new material up there. And we'll see you next time.
Yep.